Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. Today is International Workers' Day. Workers around the globe are striking to demand safe working conditions and livable wages. Health workers have also been striking to demand better working conditions and proper protective equipment. We will keep an eye on how the media report on these strikes, and we will touch on this on next week's show. Today, we are going to Brazil to find out how the COVID outbreak is affecting low-income and marginalized communities. So far, more than 81,000 people have tested positive in Brazil. At least 6,000 have died, according to Johns Hopkins. Many say the real numbers are much higher due to a lack of testing. When Brazil's President Jair Bolsonaro was asked about skyrocketing deaths on Tuesday, he said, quote, "So what? I'm sorry. What do you want me to do?" End quote. Well, today's guest, journalist Jill Langua, a National Geographic reporter, reports that the first person to die from coronavirus was in Rio de Janeiro and the fifth in the country overall. This person was a 63-year-old woman who was a domestic worker for decades in Leblon, the most expensive neighborhood in Brazil. Her boss had reportedly traveled to Italy for carnival, but allowed the woman to return to work without informing her she was feeling ill and awaiting COVID test results. The employer recovered. Jill Langua is a National Geographic contributing writer based in Sao Paulo, Brazil. In her latest piece, she writes about Brazil's vulnerable domestic workers who cannot afford to get sick. And you can find her piece at yourcallradio.org. Hi, Jill. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. How are you and your loved ones doing?
Luckily, my family and friends are all doing well, staying safe and staying healthy. So everything is good on my side.
Okay, great. Well, we're glad to hear that. Well, Jill, thank you for writing this very important piece. Before we talk about your piece, I just want to ask you more generally about what's happening in Brazil. This is a country of 210 million people. It's expected to become one of the epicenters of the COVID-19 outbreak. It already has the highest number of infections and mortality in Latin America. And a lot of criticism has been directed toward President Bolsonaro's cavalier attitude. In addition to that, this week, Deutsche Welle reported that COVID-19 is putting Brazil's healthcare system on the brink of collapse. Can you give us an update? I mentioned the numbers from Johns Hopkins, but experts say they're probably much higher.
I think that the numbers that you mentioned are pretty much what we have now as the official numbers, but we know that there's underreporting, extreme underreporting, both in cases and in deaths. There are a lot of people that I've spoken to, families who have had family members who have been buried without getting any test results back yet, and who have also lost people who were never tested. So we know that those numbers are probably quite low in terms of what the actual situation is here. And you mentioned the healthcare system. It depends on the state. Some are close to collapse, and there are other states that their healthcare system has already entered into collapse. If you look at more northern communities, northern states, they tend to struggle more and have more difficulties, particularly right now, because they have fewer beds, fewer ICU beds. In the city of Manaus, for instance, which is the capital of Amazonas, they are already in collapse, and now they are receiving patients from other smaller communities in the state who don't have any infrastructure to be able to handle this. So now they'll also be taking care of patients that are coming in from these other communities. So Brazil is really really struggling with this already. We know that things will likely get worse as time goes on. And as you mentioned, it's with the political messages that are coming out from the president, Jair Bolsonaro, it's been a struggle for governors and for mayors to really get people to wear masks, to do social distancing, to really follow those recommendations that they so desperately need people to do at this time.
Like Donald Trump, Bolsonaro is continually minimizing the impact of the virus. He has described it as a little flu. What explains this?
I mean, what he's been talking about, this little flu, he's also mentioned that, you know, he's been tested for the virus, and he has said that his tests have come back negative, but refuses to show those results. And I think part of the reason that he's gone down that road is because he wants to focus on the economy. I mean, Brazil was just coming out of a recession, and now obviously things are not going to plan, are going to get worse. People are out of work. Businesses are closing. And so by minimizing the severity of this situation, it's really just a way to try to be able to open up the country again, because like I mentioned before, governors and mayors, they're not following his lead. They have put things like quarantines in place. They've forced businesses to close. And with the president, he has gone against that and said that these measures that they've put in place are extreme, or that they're useless, was another word that he used earlier this week. So his concern seems to be focused more on the economic side of getting businesses open again, as opposed to focusing on public health.
He was elected 18 months ago with more than 55% of the vote. Is he losing support because of his stance?
I mean, I've heard from some people who say now that they might regret the vote that they cast when they voted for him, that they didn't expect that he would take this kind of stance. But he still has a very strong base. He still has a lot of support. There have been people who have protested here in his support, continuing to support him. And he's been out to greet those supporters in the streets. And so he still does have a lot of people who back him.
I also wanted to ask you, we were talking about the healthcare system in Brazil. Here in the States, nurses across the country are striking today to demand better working conditions and protective gear. What are you hearing from frontline health workers in Brazil?
I think they're going through a lot of the same difficulties that any frontline workers are going through right now in the U.S. or in any other country. They don't have the resources that they need to be able to do their jobs. They don't have enough PPE. They're short-staffed. There have been calls out for the state of Amazonas that I already mentioned. They have been asking for people to apply to jobs there as frontline workers. So there is a real shortage of not just the actual resources that they need to properly and safely do their jobs, but also people who can continue to do those jobs.
What can you tell us about indigenous groups? Because in mid-April, a number of national outlets had pieces like CNN, here's the headline, Coronavirus Fears Grow for Brazil's Indigenous Groups, Al Jazeera English, Indigenous Fear Coronavirus Could Decimate Communities. Can you give us an update on that?
Sure. Indigenous groups, of course, are particularly concerned, particularly the isolated groups. They were concerned about missionary groups who were attempting to go in to do their work in these more isolated areas in the Amazon. And a judge ended up blocking these groups from going into those communities for fear of spreading the novel coronavirus, just like in the past when measles were spread, for instance. But there's still a lot of concern that there are illegal miners and loggers who will easily be able to get into these communities to continue to do their work, and that they will bring the virus in with them. So there's still a lot of concern surrounding this, because we've seen also that rates of deforestation are going up as the virus is spreading, because it's been much more difficult to keep track of what's going on. Their focus has shifted now within the government too. And so even if we look at as well other Indigenous groups, not just isolated groups, there's a one I mentioned in Manaus. There's a city a few hours away from it called São Gabriel da Cachoeira that is known as the most Indigenous city in Brazil, just because of its high population of Indigenous people. And they've just had one of their first cases, I believe it was this week. And so they are one of the cities that will now be sending patients down to Manaus because they don't have the resources there to be able to take care of those patients.
So Indigenous groups in the Amazon, they're really dealing with two issues here: the possibility of COVID affecting their communities, and then Bolsonaro promising that he would open the Amazon to things like mining and large-scale farming.
Yeah, exactly. So there's still that concern, and there's also the worry that because the focus has shifted to the coronavirus and the pandemic, that things will be much more easier to kind of get by to open up that land for mining and logging, those types of activities to make that kind of activity legal. So they really are facing, like you said, those two big difficulties now. So one was already, I would say, hard enough for them to face, and now they've got both that they really need to focus on to keep their communities safe.
And what measures are government officials taking to ensure that people stay as safe as they can? I mean, if you have a president who's not taking this seriously, or you mentioned other politicians, what are they doing to ensure that people stay safe?
I mean, right now, I'm in São Paulo, so I can speak to what the governor has done here. They've been monitoring fairly closely how well people have been doing with staying home and with self-isolation. And, I mean, the numbers are not great. They tend to hover around 50%, sometimes dipping lower to 48% of the population of São Paulo, the state, actually staying at home and in quarantine. And the problem with that is that they needed at least 70% of the population to stay in to really slow the spread of the virus. And so there has been talk of starting to arrest people or fine people who are not following these rules that they've set out. Nothing's been particularly done in that direction yet, but it seems to be where we're heading.
Well, today we are speaking with Jill Langlois, a National Geographic contributing writer based in Sao Paulo, Brazil. We're talking about COVID in Brazil. According to the official numbers from Johns Hopkins, 81,000 people have tested positive in Brazil. At least 6,000 have died, but experts say the real numbers are much higher due to a lack of testing. And if you have any questions for Jill about what is happening in Brazil, or if you have any connections to Brazil and you'd like to share stories, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Jill, let's talk about the piece you wrote for National Geographic, Brazil's Vulnerable Domestic Workers Cannot Afford to Get Sick. You report that 18 million people work as domestic help in Latin America and the Caribbean. This is according to the International Labor Organization. Of those, 93% were women. Nearly 80% worked under informal conditions with no government regulation or protection. So talk about what domestic workers are facing specifically in Brazil. You report that many are forced to work, continue working despite the risk of COVID, and others are being left without pay.
Yeah, that's exactly the situation here. So there are some, mostly women in this case, some of the women are essentially being forced to continue going to work. They work in people's homes, generally cleaning or cooking, or there are also nannies who take care of people's children, or some people do a combination of all of those roles. And a lot of them are being forced to continue to work. They've been told by their employers that if they don't come in, that they won't have a job, they won't have any help during this time when we're in quarantine, and they won't have a job to come back to afterwards. And then there's also people who have just been let go, and there's been no notice because a lot of people, like I said, are in the informal market, so there's no proper registration of the job or anything. They don't have any rights to any kind of formal notice from those employers. So a lot of these women are really in a difficult position. I mean, if you're let go, there isn't too much you can do. You don't have much of a choice. But also, if you're told that you have to continue working, if you want to keep your job afterward, you really don't have much of a choice either, because it's either you go into work or you likely won't be able to pay your rent or feed your family. And like I reported, a lot of these women are the heads of their households. They're single mothers. And so they really need the money that they're making at these jobs.
You start the piece by focusing on Maria Raimunda Ribeiro del Almeida, and you report that initially the family she was working with got her a ride to and from the home, but now she cannot go back to her favela of over 100,000 people until Friday, because her employers told her she would have to stay at their home during the week if she wanted to keep her job. And as you report, that means that it's pretty much working constantly. How common is that?
It seems to be, and from the people I've spoken to, it seems to be fairly common. There's this the concern, of course, that if the domestic workers are coming and going every day, that they'll have more of a chance of getting the coronavirus when they're on public transportation, which is usually the way that these women get to and from work. And so people, employers, just want them to be able to stay at their homes. Most of these types of homes in Brazil, in São Paulo, when they're luxury apartments or homes, they have what they would call maid's quarters. So they have an extra, very small room where someone can sleep if they were to be hired in that capacity to live at the home. But in Maria Raimunda's case, she was not hired to live there. She was supposed to be going back home every night, like most people do when they leave work. But in this case, she was told that that's just the way that it had to be if she wanted to keep her job. And she also thought she didn't have much of a choice because she lives with her partner and an adult daughter, but they've both lost their jobs because of the pandemic. So the only income that they've had is hers. And so there really wasn't much choice for her if they wanted to keep paying their rent and being able to basically be able to feed themselves. So even in that situation, and there's many women like her, they continue to work, even though they do have that fear that going out, they will end up contracting the virus.
Mm. I was really struck by this in your piece, Jill. You report that Maria is so busy, she hardly has time to keep up with the outside world. Quote, "I don't even know what's going on most of the time. I usually watch the news, but now I work so late and there's no TV in my room."
Yeah, I mean, that's the situation, I think, for a lot of these women now, too. They're made to work constantly, especially like Maria Raimunda. If you're at your employer's home all day, all week, you really don't have any kind of downtime. You're just kind of at their beck and call for whatever they want at any time. And I know her employer in particular, they have two small children, so there's always something that needs to be done or that can be done. And so she really doesn't have any time to be able to keep up to date on really important information about the spread of the coronavirus. I mean, in our conversations, I think I was probably the one who told her a bit more about how many cases there were, how serious it really was, that it was still possible for her, even though she was no longer taking public transportation every day, she was getting an Uber that her employer was paying for on Mondays to go to work and then another to go home on Friday, but that was still dangerous for her, to go out into the public in that way. That's still a way that she could contract the virus.
Again, you report that before the quarantine, Almeida worked nine-hour days cleaning the three-bedroom, four-bathroom apartment in the upper-class neighborhood. Now that she lives there, there's no end to the workday. You report that she makes $387. Is this monthly?
That's monthly, yeah. That's okay. Her monthly salary.
And are people able to feed their families and pay their rent and their other bills on $387 a month?
It's difficult. I think people are already struggling. I think that's part of the problem here too. What's going on right now is just exacerbating other problems that have already existed for decades, with finding well-paying, proper work that people can really survive off of. Because she makes now roughly what minimum wage would be, but in a city like Sao Paulo, it's not a livable wage. And that's why families like hers end up living in favelas. She lives in Paraisópolis, which is one of the biggest favelas in Sao Paulo. There's over 100,000 residents. And a lot of families do live in these communities because they can't afford to live anywhere else on the salaries that they're getting.
$387 a month for this very difficult work. Jill, for people who are not familiar with favelas, can you just tell us a little bit about them?
Favelas are basically informal communities that have been built by the residents themselves, mostly cinder block homes, a lot of homes stacked one on top of the other because of a lack of space. So it's also very close quarters for people who live in favelas. They're working class neighborhoods. People who live there and lots who work within the community too, they work very hard for very little money, like we've seen with these domestic workers. And so their situation really in the favelas has already been difficult for a very long time. It's difficult to change the financial situation of a person who lives in a favela because of these low salaries and oftentimes just precarious work situations. For instance, for Maria Raimunda, her work is registered. It's not an informal job. She actually has, in Brazil, there's a workbook where you register all of your jobs, and hers is registered. But even though she has a job that isn't informal, it's part of the formal market, she still feels like she has no recourse to be able to complain about any kind of problems that she's had at work with employers, with her labor rights, because if she does, she would end up just with a black mark on her name and not being able to work with anybody, any other families anymore, because then she'd be known as being difficult. So for people who live in the favelas and do this type of work, the type of work that we now see is so important and essential. These are essential workers that they really have this difficulty of getting out of the situation that they're in. And the favelas are really a warm and inviting community. They're filled with really kind and, like I said, hardworking people, and they really take care of themselves more than anything. There really are. There's a real community feel in them.
Well, we're going to let you go in a minute, Jill, but we want to just take one caller. Let's go to Luciano in San Francisco. Hi, Luciano. Welcome to the show.
Hi, good morning. Just wanted to point out that the salary mentioned, $360-some dollars, is maybe the average salary in Sao Paulo, but then in the northern region of Brazil, Nordeste, which is comprised of nine states, a population of 50 55 million people, more than half of the population lives on half the minimum wage, which would be about 1,000 reais, less than $90 by the conversion rate today, 5.5 reais to the dollar. Then I have a call. I was just as I heard about your show, I was looking at the line, the sequence of phrases uttered by the Trump of the tropics, as the Bolsonaro is known internationally. It's astounding to hear the denial that comes from his. You know, he switched his stance from being a complete denier to being a somewhat denier now, but still pushing. And his hatred toward people who take the pandemic seriously. I have a list of 20 phrases here, but I won't just mention the last one that he was asked yesterday about, you know, about the number of deaths, and he said, "So what? What do you want me to do? I have nothing to do with this." But anyway, I take the comment off the air, and I appreciate the time.
Okay, thank you so much for calling in, Luciano. Final thoughts on that, Jill?
Yeah, no, he's absolutely right what he was saying about, I didn't mention the minimum wage here, but he's absolutely right. There are millions of people, mostly in the north and northeast of the country, who do live well below that and well below the poverty line. So, like I said before, too, this is the situation that we're in now. It just has basically really highlighted, shone a light on issues that were already present in the country long before this. And so now they've been exacerbated, and now just been able to see them with much more clarity.
Well, Jill, thank you so much for your work. Thank you for elevating the voices of these domestic workers in Brazil. I'm glad we were able to have you on International Workers' Day, and I hope you and your loved ones stay safe.
Great. Thanks so much, Rose.
Thank you. Jill Langlois is a National Geographic contributing writer based in Sao Paulo, and I hope you can take the time to read the piece that she wrote, "Brazil's Vulnerable Domestic Workers Cannot Afford to Get Sick." We should say that a number of community groups have stepped up to help domestic workers who have lost their jobs or are having a hard time making ends meet, and you can find that piece at yourcallradio.org. Coming up after a break, we will speak about a investigation in the Miami Herald about the spread of COVID-19 on cruise ships. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on Local Public Radio, KALW. If you have a perspective you haven't heard in today's discussion or a question that you feel needs to be answered, please join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. You can also send an email to yourcall@kalw.org or post a comment or question at the show's website, yourcallradio.org, or tweet us at yourcallradio. Coming up at 11 from WAMU in Washington, a further wrap-up of the week's news on 1A. Stay with us.
This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. Now we are going to discuss a Miami Herald investigation about the spread of COVID-19 on cruise ships. According to this report, more than 25 people have tested positive for COVID-19 during or directly after a cruise, and at least 65 people have died. Joining us is Taylor Dolvin, an award-winning business journalist who covers the tourism industry for the Miami Herald. Hi, Taylor. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. First off, Taylor, how are you and your loved ones doing?
We're doing well, thankfully. I feel really lucky.
Well, we're glad to hear that. Thank you so much for this investigation. I also want to name the other reporters who worked on this. Sarah Blasky, Nicholas Nahamas, and Alex Harris. And huge thanks to all of you for doing this. Before we dive in, Taylor, can you just give us a snapshot picture of the cruise industry? As you report, four of the world's largest cruise lines are Carnival, Royal Caribbean, Norwegian Line Holdings, and MSC Cruises. Can you just talk about just how big these companies have become? Because it seems like there are more cruise ships out there on a regular basis.
Yeah, so these are enormous companies. They employ hundreds of thousands of people. They're all headquartered in South Florida. Carnival Corporation, Royal Caribbean Cruises, Norwegian Cruise Line Holdings are all based in Miami, and MSC Cruises has its U.S. headquarters in Broward County in Fort Lauderdale. And so they're, you know, a huge presence here in South Florida, and they employ most of their people on their ships. The majority of their employees are ship-based, but they do have a lot of employees who live and work here in South Florida, too. And it's important to note, though they're headquartered in South Florida, they're all incorporated abroad, which has been the focus of a lot of conversations around whether they're entitled to, you know, federal help. They're suffering financially as much as the next company, but since they don't pay U.S. income taxes, there's been a lot of discussion about that status.
And can you tell us why they are registered as foreign corporations and not subject to U.S. income taxes? How are they able to do that?
Yeah, there's a specific, I'm not a tax law expert, unfortunately, but I've done a good amount of reading about this. There's they cite exemption under U.S. tax law, saying that they make the majority of their income in internationally.
How profitable?
And so reasons for that range, probably.
Right. How profitable are these corporations?
Extremely, extremely profitable. Last year, Carnival Corporation reported a net profit of over $3 billion. So, Carnival's the biggest company. They own, they operate 104 cruise ships. Royal Caribbean's the second biggest. They operate over 50 cruise ships. And Norwegian's the third biggest with around 27 cruise ships. MSC has 17.
So given that they are registered as foreign corporations, when they are in U.S. waters, well, really any waters, do they have to abide by environmental laws?
Yeah, there's a sort of patchwork of laws that exist here. For international waters, that's all governed by the UN, the IMO, and they have sets of requirements that companies have to meet. This year, notably, they've strengthened protections for air quality, and so companies have had to either switch to cleaner fuel sources or use these machines called scrubbers that take sulfur out of their emissions to meet those guidelines. So for international waters, that's the main body in terms of environmental regulations. And then there's the ILO, the labor, International Labor Organization. They set minimum wage recommendations for shipping companies and cruise companies that operate internationally like these do.
And a number of the crew are Filipino. A number of people are from India. Can you talk about workers' rights specifically for those members, those employers of these corporations?
Yeah, so it's also a patchwork. Some companies have collective bargaining agreements with workers, although they're not unionized in the way that we understand unions to function in the U.S. They don't have a employee representative or, you know, a sort of shop steward structure that we're familiar with here. So their representation is limited. They are all international, mostly international crew, And a lot of them do come from the Philippines, from Indonesia, from India, like you said. And right now, you know, they're in a difficult situation. A lot of them are still stuck on these ships and don't have a lot of clear communication from these companies about when they'll be going home.
Yeah, this was pretty shocking to read in your piece. You write that after offloading passengers, ships became incubators for crew infections. Approximately 120 cruise ships with more than 80,000 crew on board are currently sailing in U.S. waters?
Yeah, so cruise ships, you know, it's not as if passengers leave and you can just, you know, tie these things to a buoy and let them sit there while the industry is shut down. They do require around 100 people each to operate them, even if there are no passengers. And so they all have, you know, many more than 100 people on them now, crew, and even some passengers are actually still stuck on ships. But the companies are trying to work with the CDC to try and get these people home. It's been really complicated, and more get sick every day. We've seen dozens hospitalized here in South Florida. Several have died in South Florida hospitals after being hospitalized for COVID-19. And so even after the industry shut down on March 13th, we've seen a lot more crew get sick and a lot more die.
Wow. So 80,000 crew on 120 cruise ships. Is the cruise industry, are these companies being transparent about where these crew are from? And I'm just thinking about logistics. How are they getting food and other basic necessities?
Yeah, so the ships have, you know, come into port and load up with food and fuel and then go back into sea. It's if you look at, there's several sites that track cruise ships the same way you can track airplanes, and you'll see them going in and out of ports every few days. So they are getting food, getting fuel. They, for a lot of crew, are isolated in cabins. Some are sharing really small cabins with strangers. Some of them aren't being allowed out at all of their cabins and are having three meals a day delivered to them. There's obviously no choice in those meals. And then some are being totally isolated in cabins except for 3 hours a day, one for each mealtime. And then others are being allowed to, you know, roam the ships freely, but all of them remain trapped.
And the majority of the 80,000, are these people from the Philippines, Indonesia, and India?
They represent a big chunk of the crew. There's also a lot of crew from the Caribbean, from Latin America, from Europe, really from everywhere.
And we should say that when you say that they're in rooms, I mean, some of the rooms have balconies, some have windows, but the rooms on in the middle of the ship, they have no window at all.
Yeah, so a lot of companies have moved crew. So crew cabins typically don't have windows and are a bunk bed style, really small room. The companies have moved a crew to passenger cabins that do have windows, and some, like you said, do have balconies. But yes, some crew are in inside cabins, which means though they may be a little bit bigger than their normal crew cabins, they don't have windows.
So what is the main problem here, Taylor? Is it that a U.S. port like one in Florida doesn't want these people to get off the ship? Or is it that the country of origin is not taking their citizens back?
So it's a combination of problems. First of all, it's important to note the CDC was allowing for crew and passengers from cruise ships to travel via commercial air flight home to their countries until early April. And then they said that all repatriation needed to happen via charter flight, which is obviously more expensive and requires a bit more coordination. The CDC says they never stopped allowing for crew repatriation via charter flights. For countries that aren't allowing people to come back, that's obviously a bit more complicated and requires some diplomacy. But a lot of crew members that I'm communicating with, their companies are telling them that it's the CDC that has prevented them from being repatriated. The CDC is telling me that companies are free to repatriate crew members via charter flight. What they're requiring is company executives, including the CEO of the company, to sign off on each crew repatriation, basically saying that they will be held accountable for following the CDC guidelines for each repatriation, things like providing the crew member a mask, assuring that they won't go into, you know, big public spaces on their way home, assuring that they will, they're instructed to stay home for 14 days once they arrive, things like that. And that's what's not happening.
You quoted a Norwegian Encore crew member who was able to leave the ship, and this person said, "I'm worried we've been lied to this whole time by management. It is reckless behavior on their part and endangering. I could have endangered my family." Have you been able to talk with other, I mean, you have a couple quotes in here, but are these companies giving you access to crew members?
The companies are definitely not giving access to crew members, and in fact, they're threatening crew members with that they'll lose their jobs if they talk to a journalist. Crew members are incredibly scared, incredibly confused. They are seeing, you know, they're being told that they'll go home this day, and the next day they're being told they won't, and the reasoning is really opaque. And so I'm hearing from dozens of crew members every day who are sending me information and corresponding with me.
As of publication of your investigation, at least 11 crew members have died from COVID. 27-year-old Pujioko, a Royal Caribbean housekeeper from Indonesia, became the youngest person in South Florida at the time to die from COVID on April 12th. Andrew Fernandez, 48, from India, worked as a security guard on Carnival's Costa Favolosa cruise ship, which had at least 58 people test positive, and you report that he died alone at Larkin Community Hospital. He was the father of four. We were also wondering about the families of these crew members who are stuck on these ships, Taylor. Do you have any idea if, you know, if they've been given the correct information, what the communication is like between them and their loved ones?
Yeah, I'm hearing from a lot of them, too. sometimes crew members are too nervous to get in touch, but their family members will contact me. And no, I mean, they're totally in the dark the same way the crew members are about what's happening and what the plans for them are. A lot of them, crew members have seen their pay incredibly reduced, or cut totally. And so family members who on land who are unemployed now because of the pandemic are really concerned that their family members aren't being paid or aren't being paid as much as they were and are unable to leave. So I'm definitely hearing from a lot of family members too.
And I'm sure the pay varies, but what is an average wage for some of these crew members?
Yeah, it does vary. It depends on, obviously, your position and how long you've been there. The International Labor Organization recommended minimums are around between $600 and $700 a month, which, you know, is incredibly low compared to what, you know, minimum wage here is in the U.S. It really varies, but crew can take home several, you know, up to several thousand dollars a month, all the way down to those minimums.
And can I ask, for $600 or $700 a month, what is an average day like? I mean, hours worked, given that these crew members are on the ship 24/7?
Yeah, so it's definitely not typical work hours. They're working long days, and they're also working 7 days a week sometimes. So how it works is they're they work several months, so their contracts will be, 5 months, 6 months, 7 months, and then they'll have the rest of the year off and then start again on another contract. So the off days, instead of, you know, weekends like we're used to, are really reserved for that off time where they're home with their family for several months.
Today we're speaking with Taylor Dolvin, an award-winning business journalist who covers the tourism industry for the Miami Herald. And she and her colleagues have done extensive reporting about COVID-19 outbreaks on cruise ships. They write, cruise ships sailed on despite the coronavirus. Thousands of people paid the price. Taylor, what explains this? I mean, given that these major ships, these billion-dollar corporations, are registered as foreign corporations, when you all dug deep and looked at their business practices and what happened, why did they continue sailing on despite the coronavirus? Is it simply because they wanted the passengers on the ship to continue profits?
It's hard to know. That is the burning question everyone has. They, you know, while the U.S. Was still grappling with what the pandemic, well, not yet a pandemic, with what an outbreak in China meant for the U.S. and the rest of the world, at least Carnival Corporation had a front row seat to what this virus was like, with the largest outbreak outside China happening on one of their ships, the Diamond Princess, off Japan in February. And so from that point on, it's hard to understand. It definitely begs the question, you know, why did they keep going? Public health officials warned people not to go on cruise ships. The CDC on March 8th told all U.S. citizens to stay away from cruise ships, but the industry didn't shut down until March 13th, 2 days after the WHO declared that COVID-19 outbreak was a pandemic. So I don't have a good answer for that. I wish I did.
You all write that the cruise industry, which downplayed the dangers and kept sending out ships despite outbreaks on board and warnings from public health officials, has largely stayed silent about the toll of COVID cases and COVID deaths. Given that these corporations are registered as foreign, will they ever be held accountable?
Well, we're actually tracking how transparent each cruise company is about COVID cases on board. And so for this story, we only heard back from two companies that provided us comprehensive data about the number of people infected and the number of people who've died, and that's Carnival Corporation and MSC Cruises. The rest either declined to comment or didn't respond at all. But you mentioned accountability. Today, the U.S. House of Representatives, the Committee for Transportation and Infrastructure, actually announced an investigation into Carnival Corporation's handling of the pandemic and requested all internal and external communications and documents related to coronavirus since January 1st. So even though they are registered abroad and incorporated abroad, there are some levers here in terms of oversight, and this congressional investigation is certainly one of them.
And can you tell us how Florida became a hub for the cruise ship industry?
Yeah, it's a long story, cruising was thought of as a form of transportation, principally, you know, thinking back to the days of the Titanic, the cross-Atlantic journeys. It was a way, really a way for immigration. And those same shipping companies and ocean liner companies discovered that, you know, people really enjoyed this kind of journey and that it could be done in warm weather, too. And the access to the Caribbean, the weather here, really lured these companies in the 60s and 70s, and they all set up shop here. And we've been the cruise capital of the world ever since then. But I think the setup of the Caribbean really offers an attractive route for these ships, and good climate, obviously.
And just briefly, we're almost out of time, Taylor, but I wanted to ask you about the cruise industry's lobby group, Cruise Lines International Association. How much power does this group have in Florida and in Washington, D.C.?
like any lobby group, I think it's tough to know. You know, they're definitely well connected. There's you know, dozens of cruise lines that are a part of this group. Hardly any companies are operating that aren't associated with CLIA. But in terms of measuring their power, that's hard to gauge. They're certainly very active and very vocal, especially during this time. Whenever there's a new directive for the industry from the CDC or from the Coast Guard, it's always communicated via CLIA. And they're definitely, you know, front and center in talking to regulators and to lawmakers.
And what is next for this industry? Because on these ships, it's almost impossible to maintain 6 feet of distance.
Yeah, that's a great question. One Asia-based cruise line, Genting Cruise Line, that owns three different cruise companies, including one, Crystal Cruises, based here in the U.S., they actually published a pretty comprehensive list of changes they're already preparing to make to their operations, and those include masks for all passenger-facing crew, infrared thermometer. I'm not exactly sure what the technology is, but something on the gangway to detect temperature, cleaning of common spaces as frequently as every 2 hours. And upgrades on the kinds of disinfectants they're using. So they've been really vocal about what they already plan to do when cruising is allowed again. We haven't heard those same measures announced by any of the companies here in Florida. But I suspect certainly with this congressional investigation underway now, I think that we will be hearing more specifics about what's going to change. And I think those announced by Genting are certainly examples.
Well, Taylor, thank you for joining us. Thanks to you and your colleagues for doing this very important work.
I really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you. Taylor Dolvin is an award-winning business journalist who covers the tourism industry at the Miami Herald. Be sure to check out the investigation that Taylor and her colleagues did called COVID Cruises. Cruise ships sailed on despite the coronavirus. Thousands of people paid the price. The Coast Guard is monitoring 120 cruise ships in U.S. waters with 80,000 crew members from many different countries around the globe. The total number of Americans on board is unknown. And we will continue covering these stories and really elevating the voices of workers around the globe, especially low-wage workers. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. Thanks to David LaTulipe for keeping the studio running back at KALW. And thank you so much for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.